not looking for a war with Iran. We are not looking to escalate the tensions any more than they already have been escalating. In fact, everything we've done has been designed to try to de-escalate those tensions. That said, this was a very serious attack. It had lethal consequences. We will respond, and we'll respond appropriately. I'm not going to telegraph what that's going to look like.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby at a White House press briefing today discussing how the U.S. may respond to yesterday's drone attack in Jordan that killed three U.S. soldiers and injured more than 30. The attack marks the first time U.S. troops have been killed in the Middle East since the war in Gaza began in October. Republicans are demanding a direct attack on Iran. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said in a statement, "We cannot afford to keep responding to this violent aggression with hesitation and half measures." Well, joining us to discuss this is David Sanger, White House and national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of the forthcoming book, New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and the Struggle to Save the West. Welcome back to Press Play, David.
Great to be with you again, Madeline.
Well, first, who ordered this attack? Because Iran is saying that this was just a militia that operated independently, that it had no idea that it was going to act, and it has nothing to do with this. Is that true?
It's hard to know right now. The U.S. military is still trying to figure out exactly where the attack came from. It seems almost certain to have come out of Syria, perhaps out of Iraq. There are a number of different Iranian-backed militia groups there. Collectively, they frequently refer to themselves as the resistance or the axis of resistance, a phrase also used about Iran, North Korea, China, Russia versus the United States, but you get the direction they're headed. And it's entirely possible, American intelligence officials tell me, that the Iranians did not have direct foreknowledge that it was going to happen. Their relationship with the militias is a little bit like a franchisee in the corporate world, which is to say the supplies, the funding, sometimes the intelligence comes from Iran, but frequently the groups don't give Iran advance notice of their plans for attack or where they're going to attack. In fact, to this day, we don't believe that the Iranians knew about the October 7th attacks on Israel, the terror attacks. So it's possible that these actors decided to go off and do this without telling the Iranians first.
And what is their motivation for doing that?
Well, all of these proxy groups for Iran, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, other Hezbollah spinoffs in Iraq and in Syria, have all been reacting in large part to the Israeli bombing and occupation of Gaza. And there are some in the United States government who think that if you can actually calm down the Gaza situation, these attacks will also calm down. And certainly there's been a big effort to bring about a truce. We saw Bill Burns, the director of the CIA and former longtime diplomat in Paris on Sunday, meeting his Israeli counterpart, David Barnea, and the Qataris, trying to come up with some proposals that Hamas would also sign on to. For the time being, it looks like each one of these groups is wreaking its own revenge. And of course, they make no distinction between the United States and Israel.
And are they big supporters of the Palestinians, or are they kind of using this as an excuse to wage attacks on their enemies, the Israelis and the United States?
More the latter than the former. There's some support for the Palestinians, of course, and not every group is the same. But this is, in many respects, a way for them to press their larger cause, which is to kick the United States out of the Middle East.
Okay, so let's get to President Biden's options in terms of his response, which you say range from the unsatisfying to the highly risky. What are his plausible options?
So what's the unsatisfying part of the equation? It's going to do more of what U.S. Central Command, which runs the American forces in this region, has been doing so far, which are counterattacks on the Houthis' missile or drone emplacements, or on individual leaders of Hezbollah units in Iraq, or some other attack on the proxies. It makes you feel good for 24 hours, and you feel like maybe you're sending a message. But the fact of the matter is, most of these capabilities and weapons are hidden away, and you might degrade their capability, but you're not going to stop them. It's a little bit of whack-a-mole. That's on the unsatisfying side. On the risky side is attacking the supplier themselves, Iran.
Which is what Republicans are calling for.
Well, that's right. There are a lot of Republicans who are calling for that now. We heard it from Mitch McConnell. We've heard this from Senator John Cornyn of Texas. We've heard it from Lindsey Graham. They're forgetting a couple of things. First of all, it's easy when you're a senator to call for an attack. It's another thing to sort of think out ahead to the "and then what" of this. That seems to be lacking in some of their tweets and some of their calls. And it's worth their remembering that even President Trump, who has been talking a big line in the past 24 hours about a weak Joe Biden and so forth, pulled back really twice on different moments when he was about to go attack Iran, I think because he thought better of what the reaction might be.
And when do you expect Biden to act or to do anything in response?
I can't imagine he's going to wait that long. I would guess it would come sometime this week. You don't want to let it distend too far. I know he said, as presidents always do, at a time and place of our choosing, but you don't want that time or place to be too distant from the moment. They certainly have a lot of strike packages they've worked up. They're just trying to fine-tune what that would be. It doesn't strike me, and this is more instinct than knowledge, Madeline, that President Biden is ready yet to strike deep inside Iran. I think he believes he's got options short of that to exercise now. But he's certainly under more pressure because, you know, they were lucky for the first 150 or 160 attacks that there were American injuries but no deaths. They knew the moment would come, and it came on Sunday.
David Sanger is White House and National Security Correspondent for The New York Times and author of the forthcoming book, New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and the Struggle to Save the West. David, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Also over the weekend, the United States and a dozen other countries suspended their funding for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA. That's the main UN aid agency helping Palestinians in Gaza. This comes after Israel accused the agency of employing at least 12 people who aided Hamas in the October 7th attack. But UNRWA's work is a vital lifeline in Gaza, where people are now on the brink of famine. Joining me now is Gaith Al-Omari, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's first talk about Israel's allegations. Do you give credence to what Israel says, that several of the workers at UNRWA participated in these attacks?
I actually do. I mean, when you look at the reaction, not only of the U.S., but as you mentioned, at least a dozen other countries suspending their assistance to UNRWA, it means that there's something credible there. And, you know, for an organization that employs a total of 30,000 people throughout the region, and I think in Gaza around 13,000 people, I'm not surprised that a dozen, maybe even more, would be implicated in terror.
All right. And so what do you make of the response that the United States and at least a dozen other countries have suspended funding?
I think this is a reasonable response in terms of due diligence. I mean, when you hear such serious allegations, as a donor, you want to make sure that your money is not going to support terror. But I believe that all of these countries will reinstate their aid simply because the work that UNRWA is doing is simply crucial and indispensable, and no one else can do it. So this is a good kind of exercise of caution. But ultimately, I think bigger policy issues will prevail.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how we got here. UNRWA was established in 1949. And how did it become such a large organization providing such crucial life-saving aid to so many people?
I mean, it's UNRWA is a unique organization in that it's created to deal with a specific refugee population, that's the Palestinian refugees, unlike other agencies. When it started, we were talking about maybe 700,000-800,000 refugees. That was back in the 40s. Now we're talking about around 8 million refugees. And like many bureaucracies, it just grew and there was bureaucratic inertia. So both kind of the beneficiaries increased, but the more that the organization was in place, the more that it fell into bureaucratic norms and the structures.
And has it been accused in the past of harboring terrorists?
For sure. I mean, and there were actually cases in the past in which some of its staff were found to be involved in terror, directly or indirectly. But again, I mean, for an organization of that size, it's impossible to police each and every staffer that you've had. Mm-hmm. And in the past, it has done a reasonably good job in immediately terminating such people and referring them to the relevant authorities in the different countries in which it operates. Yet, I think in the past, often, you know, they were good in terms of responsiveness, but they were not all that good in terms of preventing some of this. So some of their internal mechanisms remain a bit lax.
Okay, so let's talk about the situation now in Gaza. 80% or more of the population is displaced, and UNRWA provides most of the housing for them in schools and other places, and also delivers food aid, which is becoming more difficult. Apparently, many Gazans are now on the brink of famine. So can you tell us what's happening there?
Actually, I mean, if I may even take it a step back and say even before the war, 70% of the Gaza population were registered refugees. Most of them relied on UNRWA. Actually, as an Israeli official once told me, you know, Israel itself preferred to have UNRWA rather than, you know, some of these people in Gaza going to Hamas schools or Hamas clinics. Today, with the war, UNRWA is playing an indispensable role. No other organization, not a UN organization, not a kind of international aid organization, has the infrastructure, the staffing, and the capacity to distribute all kinds of aid in a situation that is really tragic. We've seen some other aid organizations suspend their work because of the security situation. UNRWA, for its part, has lost, I think, more than 100 of its staffers, yet it's still there. So, you know, imperfect as it may be, I think there's an understanding, whether it's among the Israelis or among the donor countries, that without UNRWA, no possibility of doing anything on the humanitarian level exists in Gaza now.
But has Israel had a problem with UNRWA before? And because President Trump, I think, in coordination with Prime Minister Netanyahu, stopped funding for UNRWA for a while.
You know, Israel has always been critical of UNRWA. I mean, I've been involved in this business for 25 years, and from day one, the Israelis were very critical of UNRWA, and sometimes for good reason. Yet to me, it's very telling that even in areas under Israel's control, you know, West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, all of which areas Israel controlled since 1967, they never expelled UNRWA. Because for all of their complaints, UNRWA fills an essential need for the Palestinians, but also for the Israelis. Because without UNRWA, you would end up with an economic and humanitarian collapse in some of these areas, something that is not good for the Palestinians, but also not good for the Israelis. So it's always been this kind of frenemies kind of relationship. But when push came to shove, Israel always basically decided on the for the extension and the continuation of UNRWA.
Can you talk a little bit about the timing of this? Because this announcement came after the International Court of Justice in The Hague found that Gazans have no access to the most basic foodstuffs, potable water, electricity, essential medicines, or heating. That's a direct quote. And ordered Israel to allow more supplies to enter Gaza immediately. And then this announcement comes that the aid agency had these 12 or so people in it who helped with the attack on October 7th. And so some people are saying that there is a link there. What do you think?
I mean, it's very hard to think to talk about intentions. So, I mean, I don't know if it's accidental or not. But at the end of the day, the only thing I have to say is that without UNRWA, Israel will be unable to deliver, or the international community will be unable to deliver any humanitarian goods to Gaza. You know, and we see it right now, and we see a lot of aid coming to the region, basically being stuck on the Egyptian side of the border, simply because there isn't the capacity to do the distribution. If UNRWA is out of the picture, then the distribution will become zero. That will cause Israel to fail to meet its obligation in accordance with the International Court of Justice, but also will create the kind of humanitarian disaster that will basically make it impossible for Israel to continue its war or to retain any degree of international support. So, again, for all of the complaints about UNRWA right now, it's very hard to see how anyone can fill that void.
And Israel has said that Hamas is diverting a lot of this aid for itself and sort of safeguarding it and not distributing it. Is there truth to those allegations?
I mean, like every conflict, you will have combatants diverting some of the aid. I don't think it is on huge scales. But at the end of the day, UNRWA and its staff don't have guns. And if a Hamas gunman comes and demand some of this, they have no choice but to give this. I have no doubt that Hamas, which has often exploited the Palestinian civilians in Gaza, is doing this. But it's not something that today that UNRWA or anyone else can do anything about.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Gaith Al-Omari, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Up, can you run for two political offices at the same time? A candidate wants to win Kevin McCarthy's seat in Congress while keeping his seat in the California state legislature. Our Legal Eagle is here next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Congressman Kevin McCarthy surprised everyone when he suddenly resigned from the House at the end of December, just 2.5 months after his ouster as Speaker. McCarthy's hand-picked successor, State Assemblyman Vince Fong, is running for the seat, but he may not even be eligible because he's also on the ballot to keep his seat in the state legislature, and that could violate California law. Press Play's Legal Eagle Jessica Levinson is here to help us untangle this electoral knot. She's also a professor at Loyola Law School and joins us most Mondays. Hello.
Hello, the professional untangler. I'm adding it to my resume.
Please, please get your hair conditioner out because there's a tangly mess here. All right. So first of all, before we get to this, there's another mess you need to untangle. And that is there are two elections to fill McCarthy's seat.
This is an easy one. We only need a comb. So there's a special election. There's a regular election in the California Elections Code. Under the California Elections Code, Governor Newsom has to issue a proclamation. It's exactly what he did. And he said there will be a primary election on X date, which is in March. And then if nobody gets more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff election. And that will happen in May. And this will be to fill the seat that expires in December of 2024. And then, as we all know, it's an election year, so we will also be voting on the regular ballot. Essentially, if Kevin McCarthy had never stepped down, there would still be another ballot, and we would be voting on Congressional District 20.
All right. So McCarthy has endorsed Assemblyman Vince Fong, who's a Republican. He's seen as the front runner. However, the Secretary of State, Shirley Weber, says no, he can't be on the ballot. And that's because he's also running for his seat on the assembly?
That's exactly right. So she said, I'm looking at the California Elections Code, and it looks to me like you can't run for two offices at the same time. But Vince Fong had filed his papers to run for re-election in his assembly seat, and the time passed for him to try and rescind. So he was going to be a candidate for that seat. Then, based on the timing of Kevin McCarthy's resignation, he also filed papers to run for that congressional seat. Shirley Weber, as I mentioned, is looking at a provision of the California Elections Code, which frankly was intended to try and bar this particular scenario, in my view. And she said he's not eligible. He should not appear on that ballot to be the next congressperson from the 20th district.
All right. He says the law does not explicitly bar someone from seeking two offices. So what is their argument?
So his argument, which was successful in the trial court, is that, you know, whatever, essentially, whatever the California legislature intended, that's not what the law says here. And the law talks about nominations, party nominations, and independent nominations. Now, I'm emphasizing that word for a purpose, because back 14 years ago, we changed the law in California. So we don't have nominations anymore. What we have is open primaries. So everybody gets to run against everybody else. And then we have top two elections. It could be, as it sometimes has been, two members of the same party running against each other. And that's the so-called jungle primary system. So we don't go through a nomination process. And what he argued successfully is the plain language of the statute here talks about nominations. And so, again, we might know that the purpose here is to try and prevent people from running for two offices at the same time, but then California legislature go back and fix the language. And that's already what some of the members of the legislature have tried to do, which is they now see what the language said. It was never updated after we changed the law, and they're trying to update it.
Well, can they do that in time?
Absolutely not. No, they can't do it in time, and they can't do it so that it would look back and affect Vince Fong, because you have to be able to rely on the rules and the laws as they're written at the time that you take action.
All right. So what happens if Vince Fong wins both seats?
Well, it is entirely possible then, everybody's favorite use of time and resources in California, that we could have another special election. So if he were to win, for instance, the congressional seat and the assembly seat, those are the only two that he's running for, of course, then he's going to go for the congressional seat. And there would have to be a special election, my understanding is, to fill that assembly seat, which, of course, those tend to be low turnout elections and costly elections. And that's the only option I see right now.
So he can't actually hold the two seats?
No, no. I don't think that anybody views that as an option of serving as a federal lawmaker and a state lawmaker at the same time.
Okay. Because I know in New Jersey, you can hold two seats at the same time. And I think they're local. Like you can, well, that's New Jersey anyway. A whole other.
Well, I may have just been schooled live on air, but I believe that you cannot serve both it at one time. And that's in part why you have the judge, Shelly Ann Chang, saying in her opinion, I understand we're in a difficult place. And I understand that he could win both and that this could lead to a lot of voter confusion. And the California Secretary of State's appellate motion here talks a lot about that language, where she says, this doesn't really make sense. We shouldn't allow people to run for two offices. But then she kind of says, but here we are, because I'm looking at exactly what the language of the statute says.
Okay, so turning to a different race, and this is the Senate seat for, this is the Senate election for Dianne Feinstein's old seat. So what is happening there? Because there, we've got the main election happening to fill the seat, but also the unexpired term. There will also be a primary for that. So I thought that it was pretty much settled with the appointment of Senator Butler, but it hasn't been resolved.
No, we love our special elections. And this is somewhat akin to what happened, I believe, for Alex Padilla, where he was actually appointed to fill out a term, but then he ran in a special election and a regular election. And this conversation, I think, is confusing for the voters because, exactly as you said, they're wondering, why do we keep voting? Somebody was appointed, then there's going to be a general election. Why does this keep happening? And in California, we tend to have a bias towards voting is better in the sense that we don't want to get rid of special elections. Even as I said, even though they cost a lot of time and resources, even though they tend to be low voter turnout. And so for voters at home, you know, we're just getting our ballots in the next few weeks. Vote for the person who you want to be in that office and don't focus too much on the length of the terms here and what this means and why we're voting so many times.
Okay. Vote early and often. I've heard that somewhere too. Jessica Levinson, Press Play's Legal Eagle and a professor at Loyola Law School. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the lead in a new opera based on Kurt Cobain's life doesn't sing in it.
The language of opera that everyone else is singing is super alienating to this character who is on the precipice of death and is as alienated as a human could be.
Last Days comes from London to Los Angeles. We'll talk with its creators next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the 2005 film Last Days, a successful rock musician named Blake is withering away. He's fresh out of rehab, still battling a drug addiction, and neglecting his family and his career.
Are you going to play the tour? It's going to be a shame if you don't make these days.
Have you talked to your daughter? Do you say I'm sorry? And I'm a rock and roll cliche.
The movie was written and directed by Gus Van Sant, and the character of Blake was modeled on Nirvana's Kurt Cobain.
Yes, I want you to be as a friend, as a friend, as I'm known and be.
Well, Last Days has now been adapted into an opera, and it'll make its U.S. debut with the L.A. Film next week. Joining me now is the composer, Oliver Leith, and the librettist and co-director, Matt Copson. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Great to be.
Great to have you. All right, so Oliver, let's begin with you. You were a composer in residence at the Royal Opera House in London, and that's when you decided that you wanted to make your first opera centered around Last Days, or at least taking off from the idea of this movie. And take us through that thinking. Why did you want to do that?
There's something about in the film about mundanity and everydayness and magic within that as well. And it's based on a myth we all know. We know that the what happens to the character at the end. So all these sort of everyday mundane things are sort of reframed with this sort of, well, there's a heaviness and a heightenedness to them. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a perfect vehicle to explore. Well, it's, you know, it's a joint interest of Matt and I is to coax that sort of magic out of those sort of things.
Right. And so, Matt, how did you think about writing this opera and how you wanted to convey, I don't know, the songs and the mood and the feeling of someone who was caught up in worldwide fame and yet felt so alone?
Well, a central idea that we had early on was to not give the central character, Blake, our Kurt-esque character, a voice. So the language of opera that everyone else is singing is super alienating to this character who is on the precipice of death and as alienated as a human could be. And that felt like a really exciting development theatrically, to have somebody who everyone is obsessed with, who you can't keep your eyes off of in so many ways, because there is the kind of known iconography of this archetype we're dealing with the famous white sunglasses and the kind of clothing that they're wearing, and yet they don't have a voice. They're not allowed to express in the same way that these super expressive opera singers are. So that really kind of gave me an in to the writing of it. Every single character revolves around this one person the whole way through, and that's their very kind of meaning to life. And that to me seemed to start to embody the true tragedy of this symbol that we are dealing with, the worldwide obsession with somebody who doesn't really want to be here anymore.
Mm. So Blake doesn't sing in the opera.
Blake mumbles in the opera, and that's kind of musical in its own way.
And there are super titles for the mumbling.
There are, and there are super titles for everyone, in fact.
And Blake is played by a French actress named Agathe Roussel. And so just talk about why you wanted to cast her to play Blake.
I'd seen Agathe in the film Titane, which won the Palme d'Or a few years ago, and her performance was extraordinary. It's extremely physical and feral, and it had a kind of attitude within it that I wanted to incorporate into Blake, an animalistic approach to performance, where somebody really has to express so much with their body because they don't have a voice themselves. And she seemed like the perfect fit for it. And when I first spoke to her, I said, you know, I don't know if you've heard of this film. She said, maybe I've seen it about 15 or 20 times. She was kind of obsessed with this. Her life as a teenager
really
had been driven by Nirvana. So she was the exact kind of, cultural person that this was dealing with and grappling with. So it became clear to me. And I was super open when we were thinking about the casting of who we would approach, because it wasn't about necessarily making like an exactitude of, you know, putting on the prosthetics of the original person this might be kind of riffing off. It was more about that kind of the symbolism and, you know, the glasses themselves, the hair, these forms of fashion.
Yeah, they do take on a life of their own. And so there is an irony there, because from what I understand, Kurt Cobain hated that. He hated this whole idea of fame and of fashion. And just, again, he wanted to disappear and did. But his iconography has survived in that way. Is that what you're saying with the glasses and the kind of ratty fur coat?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a massive hypocrisy within all of this. You know, the very act of rebellion is something that in our world now will always be assimilated. And so now the very same ripped jeans are, you know, $2,000 versions of the same ripped jeans. And, you know, the idea of an avant-garde doesn't really exist to us anymore within culture. And maybe that period of the 90s was the last hurrah, the last attempt at something like that. And even within the original character of Kurt that you see within the archetype of Blake, there is this conflict there. There is, you know they look good. They kind of wanted the attention. They wanted to be the rock and roll hero. And it all kind of spectacularly went wrong.
Hmm. And Oliver, are you a fan of Nirvana and the music?
I am, but there's absolutely nothing. There's nothing in there from that, really. I mean, it's set apart from Nirvana and grunge. There's a tiny nod to it with a small guitar moment, which sort of plays within that sound world. But it was important for me to distance it from that. You know, the main thing about this is that it is opera, and they're singing like opera singers, and that world is stifling and, as Matt said, alienating. I mean, it's more in this score, the house itself is musical as well. So this alienation continues into sort of objects. And so, you know, why is everyone singing? But also, why is the doorbell singing? Why are the trees singing, etc.? So there's nothing of Nirvana in there.
Well, talk a little bit about the irony, I suppose, if that's the word, of you staging this kind of anti-opera in at the Royal Opera House, which is, you know, one of the foremost opera houses in the world for traditional opera.
I mean, it's anti-opera in a way, but actually it's an embrace and push of the art form, I think, more than it being anti. You know, like, it's very much like we're using the tropes of it as an important, like, bed to then move away from. So we're sort of using the familiarity of some of those tropes. I mean, even the idea of suicide, etc. But even musically as well. You know, there's what we describe as a verismo aria in the middle of the opera that we sort of frame as like Blake's favorite music. He listens to what is essentially a sort of Puccini-esque aria, as if that was his favorite music.
And the role of any form, especially ones that might be considered more dead, is to continuously reinvent themselves. At the time, Nirvana was pop music, but now pop music is something altogether different. And it's the same for any form, be it art, be it opera, whatever. In order to remain relevant to the contemporary, it must kind of reinvent itself and destroy what became before.
But do you still like traditional opera or no?
Sometimes. Depends how it's staged.
Is there one that you've seen recently that you like?
That's politically troublesome for me. Not that I can remember, let's put it that way. It's a funny thing. It's a big part of wanting to work with Matt, actually, was, you know, I guess it's a thing about this generation of artists as well, is like, we have interests outside of just being composers or whatever. And so therefore we have ideas about how things might look, or like, you know, how they might spin out in reality. Because there's a version of this opera that would look absolutely atrocious, you know, like the visual language belonging to a more English traditional twee thing would be the worst approach possible to this.
Yeah, and I also knew very little about opera when I came into it. I'm a artist in kind of the visual realm first and foremost, but I also work with musicians, make directing videos, all of this kind of thing. And for me, it was a constant question of, well, what is an opera? And the answer I came up with is, well, it's just a combination of all the different forms. And what could be more contemporary than a hybridization of different cultural forms? That's kind of how the internet is. That's how I understand culture to be anyway, right now. And so therefore, it seemed like it could speak to the present day much more strongly than something that exists on its own in an older space.
Hmm. Can you elaborate on that? An opera is a combination of all the different forms. What forms?
So an opera combines theater, staging, liveness, with music, with costuming, with fashion, with acting, with all of these different, and with movement as well. And so there are all of these forms that kind of take from film, that take from art, that take from ballet, that take from music. And then Ollie's music as well isn't just subscribed to a traditional orchestra. There's electronics at play, but there's also strange uses of percussions. There's bottles, and there's rakes, and there's bin bags. There's all these everyday items in it. So for us, it was, yeah, really about combining the material of the world around us now as we see it, and trying to speak to the present day.
All right, so let's play an aria from the opera. This version is sung by the indie artist Caroline Polachek. Oliver, is happening at the moment when the audience hears this song?
The idea is that this is the time where he's first on his own in the opera, I mean, other than the very beginning. And it's like a moment of, you know, peace. And it's like the first bit of control. And that control is also mimicked by, he also touches the record. and the orchestra are playing along with this record, and it's like you can bend time by bending this. So like the liveness of the orchestra, they descend with the pitch whenever the record is pressed on.
And will she be there on stage singing it?
No, it's a pre,
or is it recorded?
It's a pre-recorded thing. It's actually, it now exists as a physical vinyl. No, for various reasons, we don't actually end up using the actual vinyl for a thing, but maybe one day, whenever we have more time to rehearse, we would do that. But yeah, it's a pre-recorded. You see Blake put on the record, and then it spins, and he can play with it, basically.
And it's reprised later on, yeah, again by a character who's a super fan of Blake's, who sings along to it, presumably in the knowledge that this, within our world, is Blake's favorite piece of music. And I always kind of thought about this when I was directing it as being a kind of attempt from Blake to see if music still had the kick he needed in the world. It's like an attempt towards the kind of sublime transcendence that you can get from music.
Well, it sounds really fascinating. I don't think I've heard of anything quite like this before, so I'm eager to see it.
Thanks. That's the aim.
Thanks for saying that. That's not good.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
That's Matt Copson and Oliver Leith. You can see their opera, Last Days, at the Walt Disney Concert Hall on Tuesday, February 6th. How Knott's Berry Farm pretty much created the boysenberry. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Knott's Berry Farm jams and jellies will no longer be sold in grocery stores. Smucker's purchased the brand back in 2008, and the company says it will be, quote, dedicating resources to the areas with the greatest growth potential. Almost a century ago, Walter and Cordelia Knott's Berry Farm was a growing enterprise. First, it was a roadside berry stand. Then came restaurants, shops, eventually the theme park that still bears its name. And the berries, well, one shined above all the rest. Invented or hybridized here in Southern California, the boysenberry. Eric Linksweiler is co-author of the book Knott's Preserved, From Boysenberry to Theme Park, The History of Knott's Berry Farm. And he's a freelance designer right now for Knott's Berry Farms. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. All right. So first, let's discuss the boysenberry, which I just learned is not a real fruit, or at least it's not one you can find in nature. So how was this thing created?
Well, it was a long time ago, about the 1920s, a man by the name of Rudolph Boysen wound up developing a boysenberry in Orange County. He hybridized three different berries in order to create this giant, sweet, tart, unnamed berry. He had a lovely, gigantic berry, but he didn't name it. He didn't know how to promote it or sell it, and he could just kind of abandoned it. And then comes along Walter Knott, famous for his berries at his berry farm over in Buena Park. He tracked down Rudolph Boysen through the Yellow Pages and said, hey, I want to give this berry a shot. So in 1932, Walter Knott cut some clippings off of some wild berry vines that Rudolph let go fallow. And the boysenberry came into existence about 1934, when Walter Knott had a bumper crop of these gigantic, wonderful berries. Walter wound up naming them after Rudolph Boysen. And that's pretty much all he ever gave Rudolph Boysen was the name.
Oh, what were the three berries, or what are they, that go into a boysenberry?
A boysenberry was made from a red raspberry, a blackberry, and a loganberry combined by Rudolph Boysen.
All right. And people lapped it up, I guess. So Walter Knott then created his signature jams and jellies involving the boysenberry?
It wasn't just Walter Knott. We really have to give credit to Cordelia Knott. Cordelia Knott was his wife, but even though Walter gave us a berry, it was Cordelia who gave us jams, jellies, boysenberry juice, boysenberry pies. She basically gave us a long-term boysenberry. So Walter's produce could last a week, but Cordelia's jams and jellies could sit on a shelf for months.
And that paved the way for everything we have now, including Knott's Berry Farms, the theme park?
If you can believe it, Knott's Berry Farm today is probably the only theme park in the world based on a farm. Knott's Berry Farm was founded on a boysenberry and a fried chicken dinner. Have you ever had the fried chicken at Berry Farm?
I have not. Should I?
Yes, you must. So it was Cordelia Knott who gave us the boysenberry preserves and jams and pies, but she also gave us a fried chicken dinner in 1934. And what I love so much about Knott's Berry Farm is that same fried chicken dinner with biscuits and jam, with corn, with rhubarb on the side, it's still available today at Knott's Berry Farm. And the same thing with those preserves.
So they sold off the jams and jellies to Smucker's back in the 90s, right?
Yeah, it was about 1995 that the Knott family, the children of Walter and Cordelia Knott, sold off the Knott's Berry Farm brand to ConAgra, which then sold it to Smucker's.
And why did they do that?
Money. The simple answer is money. There was a lot of value to the Knott's Berry Farm brand name. The jams and jellies were produced on Knott's Berry Farm's Buena Park property for decades. Eventually, they grew, they expanded, they had nationwide reach for the Knott's Berry Farm brand name. And with that nationwide reach, I think the children of Walter and Cordelia Knott said they wanted to retire. So they wound up selling the brand name to ConAgra in about 1995. And Knott's Berry Farm, the theme park, would just buy back the Knott's Berry Farm brand jams and jellies at that point.
And then what did they do to the jams and jellies when they mass marketed it, when Smucker's mass marketed it? Like, did they change the recipe?
Oh, very much so, yes. That's one of the reasons why I'm not all that upset about the loss of the Knott's Berry Farm brand, is because that ingredient deck is not quite what it used to be. So instead of using sugar, they wound up using corn syrup. For nationwide production, they wound up using lots and lots of long-worded chemicals. And it just wasn't the same for me. I'm really kind of dedicated to what is now the Berry Market brand over the Knott's Berry Farm brand. So if you ask, am I going to be rushing to the grocery store to buy the last Knott's Berry Farm brand Smucker's produce? I'm not. I'm not that upset about it.
So you can still buy the original, the Berry Market, and it's marketed under Berry Market, not Knott's Berry Farm.
Exactly. And I have to say, it kind of makes me upset that when the Knott's children sold off the Knott's Berry Farm brand in 1995, they sold the name. So Knott's Berry Farm itself cannot use the Knott's Berry Farm name on their own food production jams and jellies, which is why Knott's Berry Farm is selling the Berry Market brand, which is named after their 1928 Berry Market. So Walter Knott founded the Berry Market as a roadside stand in 1928, and almost 100 years later, it's still going strong and selling its own brand of Berry Market produce,
including the boysenberry jam.
Very much. Nowadays, the Berry Market at Knott's Berry Farm sells, I want to say that over the years, they put out like 100 variations of boysenberry foods.
Wow. They're really taking that idea from Rudolf Boysen and running with it.
Well, it's infinite. You can put a boysenberry in anything sweet. You can put it in anything, even savory. One of their most popular items is boysenberry barbecue sauce. And I got to say, it's really good.
Mm. All right. Okay, so this is a happy ending. It's not an ending. It's a continuation.
It is a continuation. It's not a sad thing. The boysenberry will live on at Knott's Berry Farm under the Berry Market label.
And you can get it online.
Knott's.com/marketplace.
Okay. Here's to the Boysenberry. Eric Linksweiler, co-author of the book Knott's Preserve, From Boysenberry to Theme Park, The History of Knott's Berry Farm. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Go get some of that fried chicken.
Yeah, that sounds delish. Thank you. And now I'm hungry. All right, that does it for Press Play on a Monday. Don't forget to follow us on the socials. We are at KCRW, and I am at The Mad Brand. And I am Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.